This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Shirley Manson.
Let me dirty up your mind. I'll strip away your heart veneer and see what I can find. This is what he pays me for. I'll show you how it's done. Pain you feel like father.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. And this episode in the series sees me welcome a great guest into the studio, someone who, from an unassuming musical beginning in our home city of Edinburgh, went on to front a band that conquered the world, I think it's fair to say, releasing a string of what MTV called back then alternative anthems like Stupid Girl, Only Happy When It Rains, and that track you just heard, Queer. An activist and an actress, as well as a singer, she's also earned a well-deserved reputation as a forthright, funny, honest, and brilliant interviewee. So for all these reasons, and many more, I'm very pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Shirley Manson. Hey Hear me and Shirley discuss her biggest musical influences growing up. This is where Susie and the Banshees meets the Sound of Music and her first experiences of playing live and performing herself. We also chat about the pressures that came with Garbage's massive and rapid success, her deep passion for Patti Smith and PJ Harvey, and about how her band is now experiencing something of a renaissance at the moment and enjoying a new wave of affection. But I started by asking Shirley, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
Very first musical memory I have that was significant was being in my local church hall where my mum was performing with the church concert party, and I was sitting in little baby seats with my sisters, and my mum came on stage and sang On a Clear Day.
On a clear day, rise and look around. See who you are.
And she was wearing a white dress with blue cornflowers on it. And I just remember looking at her and she was singing. And I was like, who is this goddess who's normally wearing a pinny and, you know, cooking by the stove? I mean, my mum was such a traditional mum, it's like a joke. And then to see her in this, like, transformed, you know, a goddess was surreal and really marked me. Like I said, I mean, I can see it clearly as though it was yesterday.
That's where it all starts.
That's where it all started, yeah.
See and show, you can hear from far and near, a world you've never heard before. And
fantastic.
Yeah.
So also, I mean, for you, the idea of music representing something and having an emotional sort of connection, it starts at that one moment.
I think it's definitely started there. I mean, obviously, my sisters had the same experience, but it didn't affect them. They didn't become singers. But that was a powerful moment for me where I realised music can transform people into superheroes.
It's something we have heard you talk about your first single before. It is one of those questions we do have to ask it. Because the first single is one that you still own and hold dear?
Yes. Well, I mean, I have many records that I bought around the same time. I had a bunch of 7-inch singles that I clasped to my chest with great ardour. And I have talked many, many times about the first single I ever bought, which was White Horses, which was a theme song to a Czechoslovakian TV show that I was obsessed by.
To a world my heart can understand, it's a gentle, warm and wonderful.
But I also have a little double-A-sided single with Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam and A Spoonful of Sugar Helps the Medicine Go Down.
Yeah.
And that was also a big game changer for me, you know.
Like, why?
Just those songs were, they had a profound effect on me, especially Jesus Wants Me as a Sunbeam, because I was about as far away from a sunbeam as you can possibly imagine.
Jesus wants me for a sunbeam to shine for him each day. In every way try to please him, at home, at school and at play. A sunbeam, Jesus wants me for a sunbeam. A sunbeam, a sunbeam, I'll be a sunbeam for him.
Were you one of the sort of sit cross-legged next to the record player facing the speakers, kids? Did you do that?
Yeah, we had a red vinyl record player, and I was obsessed with music very early on. I mean, I remember sitting there with the record sleeve of The Sound of Music and just listening to those songs over and over again. And it had a booklet that came with the vinyl, which was like, you know, a 12-page booklet, which had photographs from the film, and I was obsessed with Hans, the older child. And, you know, yeah, I was just obsessed, absolutely obsessed.
What about the first music that you went to go and seek out that belonged to you?
Susie and the Banshees.
Go on, tell me about that.
Well, that was just the first band that I really connected with on a very deep level for a multitude of reasons. And it changed my life forevermore and forged, one would say, my musical taste and direction. Mm. I would still sort of offer the fact that Susie informs a lot of my decisions still to this day, you know, like...
What would Susie do?
Well, kind of, you know, like, I loved how exotic she was, a non-conformist she was. Previous to seeing Susie from Susie and the Banshees, I'd only ever really seen women in conventional roles, you know, and conventional dress and conventional ways of expression. And then I saw this creature who I wasn't unsure whether she was man or woman for a start. And I was obsessed with Native American Indians when I was young. Mm. And so she looked to me like a First Nation warrior, you know. And I was so into her sort of tribal, like, couture and her attitude. I just had never come across anything like it, and I would want to be her. And, you know, she still is one of my favourite icons of all time.
Have you crossed paths with her?
I have.
And how was
it was gorgeous, because, you know, they do say never meet your heroes, and I have met a few of my heroes and had somewhat awkward or unpleasant encounters with her. It was kind of extraordinary because she knew that I was madly in love with her, and I mean, I've talked about her my whole career, so she was very generous and kind. And yeah, I was sort of like a dribbling, drooling fool. I couldn't really put a sentence together, but we met at the MTV Awards up in Scotland one year, and it was extraordinary to spend time with her and be able to say thank you in person. It was powerful.
What's the track we should play?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have my own personal favourite, which is Drop Dead Celebration, but I don't know if that's fit for your airwaves, is it?
Why wouldn't it be?
There's swearing in it.
How much swearing?
I don't know. I can't remember. I mean, my idea of not a lot is some people's too much. So I would say let's put her ode to mental health on the radio, Happy House by Susie and the Banshees.
Thank you.
When did you realise you could sing? When did you first think, this is something I can do?
Well, it depends what you mean by that, because I was told very early on I was a good singer.
Okay.
I was pulled out of a dance lineup when I was three in my local ballet school to sing Never Smile at a Crocodile. So I knew that I was able to hold a tune.
Three?
3 years old.
Wow.
And singing my heart out, and the ballet teacher took me in the front of all the other children because I guess she thought I was doing a good job, and I was mortified. I looked at my shoes the whole time, and I sang in a choir from when I was about seven onwards. So yeah, I knew I could sing, but I didn't know I could ever front a band. You know, it never even crossed my mind. I sort of fell into performing with a band completely by default. It was not something I ever imagined for myself. I wanted to be an actor. That's what I was hoping for.
Going back, we should talk about the first gig that you went to that really made an impact.
Again, there's so many, and being that I've already talked about Susie, I will talk about somebody else. I went to see the Pogues in Edinburgh at the Playhouse.
Wow.
And I was scared and mesmerised, and my heartbeat changed. You know, there was something physical that happened in my body, and I got sort of addicted to live music after that. Even though I was scared, I liked it. I liked the feeling of, oh, this is kind of crazy. These fans are nuts. Yeah, I just loved the sort of camaraderie of that show and the wildness of it. It felt so free and wild and out of all the rules, and I loved that.
Yeah. So that you say camaraderie, is the gang thing of a band important to you? It's like, you know, I remember you see pictures of The Clash and you're like, that's the best gang ever. Or like, bands have that. Specials had it. Some bands have got that.
Oh, yeah, they've got it.
Has it always been important to you?
I'd like to have been in The Clash. I'd like to have been in that gang.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah, clan. I mean, I'm Scottish, so the idea of a clan is powerful to me and always has been. I love gangs, and I love the idea of everyone serving each other. You know, I just like that concept. I feel like solo artists are one thing, but it's easy to serve yourself, yeah? But when you're trying to compromise and trying to come together and use each other's best strengths, I think there's something really poetic and exciting about that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, bands for me are beautiful structures.
Francisco Vasquez Garcia, and welcome to Alemania. And we are Cincas and Canleche, we are Fiesta and Fania. We are the son of the Chichona, we are Brandy and half Corona. And Leonardo and his accordion, and Calamari and Macaroni. Come all you rambling boys of pleasure, and ladies of Maria once again.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Another very big first. Your first impressions of Duke Stephen Butch?
My first impressions were poor. I cannot lie. They were very poor.
Go on. Go on.
Well, I just remember my heart sinking because I'd been given the call, like, you know, that Butch Vig, this incredibly successful producer, is very interested in working on a song with you. Now, who wouldn't love that phone call, right? And I was like, ooh, okay. And he's worked with Nirvana. Cool. He's going to be the hippest cat I've ever met in my life. And I go down to London and I go to the Landmark Hotel on the Edgewater Road and I walk in and they're at the very back of the hotel. I can still see it now in the glass sort of breakfast area. And they stand up to meet me. And my heart kind of sinks because they look like three regular dudes. They don't look exotic. I thought they'd look like maybe Kurt Cobain if I was lucky, you know, like really handsome and cool and tortured. And they were instead like a good bunch of sweet Midwestern dudes from Wisconsin and very wholesome. And I don't know, I was a wee bit sort of like disappointed, if the truth be told. But then I talked to them. And we had brain meld. We had the same sense of humour. We liked the same movies. We loved the same bands.
Was that really immediate? Because bands talk about this.
It was immediate.
From the first rehearsal it happened, you're like, well, did it really? But did it feel like that in terms of the characters, really?
Yeah, it really felt like we had a really good laugh and we really got along. And I remember saying to them, I shook their hands outside of the hotel and said, well, you know, good luck with your project. I hope it all goes well. And I shook their hands and I walked off and I went home. And it was that very night that Kurt Cobain was found deceased. And that was sort of the beginning of my whole adventure. But that day has really stuck in my mind for obvious reasons. It was a profound experience.
First Garbage single, Vow, early 95. It stood up well, that song.
Still sounds cool, right?
It still sounds really, really good. I love first singles and first albums. I mean, you know, you expect a development from an artist. It's always really good. But that first crack of the whip, the first one out the gate, is always a bit special.
Yeah, I have a lot of love for that song, which is funny because I remember, you know, Butch not particularly wanting that song on the record.
Really?
Yeah, strangely enough. But I always loved it. And I remember we had gone to see R.E.M. play in Chicago. Butch had driven me to see R.E.M. play. And we got back in the car and switched the radio on to drive back to Madison. And on came Vow, our first single. It was one of the first times it ever got played on American radio. And it felt like I was having multiple orgasms right there in Butch's car. It was just such a cool moment, you know, such a cool moment.
What I can't abuse, and I can't stop when it comes to you.
This is the first time with me, Matt Everett, and that was Vow by Garbage, their very first single released early in 1995. It was initially just a track on an indie compilation album, but got so much attention that it was given a full release and ended up just grazing the top 100 in the US.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio.
Six Music.
I'm only happy when it rains.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Shirley Manson. And that was Only Happy When It Rains, taken from Garbage's self-titled debut album, which came out in August 1995 and sold millions, going platinum all over the world. Not bad for a group that only formed in April the previous year. There's no such thing as an overnight success, but, you know, the foot was firmly on the accelerator, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
How did that feel?
It was intense, you know, because I'd been in a band, Goodbye Mr. McKenzie, mm-hmm. for a decade, and we had very little success. We had a little bit of chart success, and we struggled to survive. And so I was used to putting my shoulder against the wall and pushing and not really anything giving. Then all of a sudden it felt like I just sort of took a finger and pushed the door, and the whole thing exploded open. And we enjoyed a peculiar and extraordinary rise to popularity. It was so fast. We couldn't keep up with it, literally. We couldn't get songs recorded fast enough for our record label, who were freaking out because they wanted to capitalise, as they do, of course.
More product.
Yeah, more product. And so we were under the gun a lot, and we always felt like we were chasing our tails. We never, ever felt like we'd quite arrived. It was just constant trying to catch the train, you know?
It seemed from the outside.
Yeah.
Single track.
Yeah, well, we enjoyed an extraordinary run, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All the way through the first two records, actually, I was like, this is too good to be true. We cannot sustain this. This is mental. But the fact that we even managed to follow up the debut record with the second, which was equally as successful, was really extraordinary and surreal.
Where does that doubt come from then?
Oh my God, you don't want to go into that. It comes from all kinds of things. I mean, it starts with my academic father who grades everything. Every single thing I ever do in my life gets graded by my dad, which is really cute, but also extraordinarily annoying. And, you know, like if I cook him a meal, he'll grade it out of 10. He'll give me marks out of 10. So, you know, I think some of it comes from that. Some of it just came from the fact that I didn't ever feel like I got success on my own merit. You know, I was very aware that I was given an incredible leg up. You know, I joined a band with someone who's extraordinarily talented and had been, you know, knighted a god of, you know, of music production. And I was intimidated by that. And I felt, I guess I gave away all my power. Now, I think you should always share your power with your bandmates, always. But you must never give it entirely away. I mean, looking back now, I understand that I also played a major role in breaking the band.
Yeah.
But I didn't see that at the time. I just thought, oh, I'm here for the ride and I'm lucky and anyone could be sitting on this saddle right now and be doing as good a job. But no, I mean, I know that that's not the case now, but at that time I was just like, I'm not worthy.
And being famous, being known by other people who you don't know for doing something or for their idea of you, did you cope with that well?
I clearly did because I didn't have a nervous breakdown. I never missed a show.
There you go.
I mean, I was a tank. But the inner turmoil was difficult to stomach a lot of the time. I mean, I was very self-conscious. I felt that I wasn't good enough. I wasn't smart enough, pretty enough, talented enough. I mean, I tortured myself and I was always looking at other, you know, people in my position who I felt were all doing things much better than me.
Even when you're walking out in front of vast audiences and creating really good music and getting these awards and...
Well, it's funny because my perception was always of struggle. But but again, looking back, I went through some of our content. We were putting a book together last year and I had to go through a lot of the old content. I was so bowled over by how much good press we got. But I did not receive it that way. I didn't feel any love. I just felt the odd moment when somebody would give me a boot in the neck. That's what I felt and that's what I remembered. So my perception was so skewed.
Yeah.
I held on to any negative and I totally ignored all the good stuff. And then looking back now, I'm like, oh my God, we were so loved. Why did I not feel it? You know?
Patti Smith. Yes. When did you first fall in love with Patti Smith?
The singer of my first band, Cabarmus McKenzie, had extraordinarily good taste and he introduced me to Patti Smith. He was like, I think you need to check this woman out. And he made me go home and listen to Horses and Wave. And he was right. I was immediately like really smitten with her and intrigued and inspired by her.
Yeah.
And she remains one of my touchstones, one of the women that I really look up to and who has allowed me to believe it's possible for me to have a career beyond being, you know, 30 and...
What's the Patti Smith track we should play?
Revenge.
Why that song?
It's my favourite Patti Smith song. That's an easy no-brainer.
Let's do some celebrating. Come on, honey. Don't hesitate now. You withdrew. I was so forsaken. Oh, now the tables have turned my mood. Can't believe. Lay
had obscured and fazed my view of the wicked hand you played on the sands and hands of time have run out, run out. Oh, you better face it. Oh, this thing's run amok, this luck. I do know how.
I mean, looking back at so many of the interviews that you did, it's really good when somebody uses their platform to talk about things they find are important and push their passions and calling people out. But then you reach a situation where you become, oh, you're the outspoken one. And then every interview you're going to do, someone's going to be going, they're going to be nudging for that comment. And then you become, yeah, the outspoken one, which is quite a narrow way of thinking about anybody.
Well, I mean, the world puts us all in our narrow little lanes and God forbid we ever step outside of them, you know. But, you know, if I'm known as an outspoken person, I'm happy. I'd rather that than be the gagged one. I like living free, you know what I mean? And I don't want to impinge my natural exuberance because people don't like me talking, you know. People are always telling women to shut up. I don't necessarily listen to them.
The workload was immense. And I read in 1998, you came off tour, then just carried on living in a hotel.
Yeah.
That's a good plan.
That's a healthy plan.
If you want to separate your work life and your home life, just keep staying in the same environment that you are when you're working. How did you crack that? How did you deal with that world
better? I didn't crack it. I mean, it was really insane. When I look back on what happened, It was mad. I lived in a mental hotel that was literally like something like The Shining.
Where was this?
In Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, of course.
On the banks of one of the lakes, I think Mendota, but it might have been Minota because there are two. It's an isthmus, so there's Madison sandwiched between two lakes. And my hotel looked out over a lake which would freeze in the winter. And it was like living on the edge of the tundra. And I was the only person in the hotel sometimes. I mean, it was
that
mad.
That is The Shining.
Yeah, it was The Shining. And I couldn't drive, so I was sort of like a little shut-in. And I didn't really have any friends because the band were all older than me and all their friends were much older. And I just never really got to know them very well. And I don't know, it was a strange time, but we went on tour for 2 years and then we went straight back into recording.
2 years.
Our second record. And then we toured that record for 2 years. So, I mean, it was unbelievable workload. But we did it. And I'm really glad we did it because we forged relationships all over the world with our fans. Like when you play for people, something alchemic occurs. You know, it's different from them just hearing you on the radio. When,
yeah.
when they see you in the flesh and you share a night together, that's intense. And they don't forget it. And they're loyal. And we've had unbelievable loyalty from our fans. It's kind of silly.
Cinema is obviously something very important to you. Is there a film score or film soundtrack that really floats your boat, that really has a big emotional impact on you?
Probably, oh my God, there's so many, to be honest.
It could be The Jungle Book, or it could be Lawrence of Arabia, or anything in between. It doesn't necessarily have to be.
Well,
poignant.
I've already mentioned Sound of Music. That was a huge one. Blade Runner would be another one. Diva would be another one. Betty Blue. I mean, I've always been really attracted to movies and music and the way they fit together.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
What should we play?
Oh, well, we have to play something from Sound of Music. We have to. And it would have to be something good, because that's my song. Somewhere in my wicked childhood, I must have done something good. Nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever should. But somewhere in my wicked childhood, I must have done something good.
Perhaps I had a wicked childhood. Perhaps I had a miserable youth. But somewhere in my wicked, miserable past, there must have been a moment of truth. For here you are standing there loving me. Whether or not you should. So somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. Nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever could. So somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something.
As a band, Garbage, you don't mind a hiatus, but you've never done a full, right, that's it, we are drawing a line under it. And that's interesting in itself.
Yeah, I think that's interesting too. Although, again, you know, nobody cares about the truth. And so, although we protested wildly at the time that we were just going on hiatus, everyone said, oh, they've split up.
Mm.
And that still haunts us to this day. People say, you split up. And we're like, no, we didn't. Mm. We didn't split up. We took a break, a much needed break, and then some terrible shit started happening. And so in some ways, I feel like we were meant to take a break, because my mum was diagnosed with a really, really desperately aggressive form of dementia that took her out of the game in 18 months, you know. And then my friend of mine lost her young husband, and friends of ours lost a kid. It was one thing after another. We literally spent 2 years in funerals. And it was a very, very dark, difficult time. And I'm just so grateful I wasn't out on the road, because I would have probably lost my mind, you know. I was able to be around for my mum's last few months and actually experience what grief is. You know, I could feel it instead of shutting it off and having to deal with it months or years down the line. I could sit in it and know really what was happening and who I was losing and how, and really face it. And as a result, you know, I was able to process it, I think, in the end. But, we don't believe in splitting up, me and my boys. We never will. We'll never split up. We'll just fade away.
Another artist, PJ Harvey.
Yummy.
Yes. What was the first track of hers that you heard and
Dry.
Felt? Yeah? Mm. When was that?
I don't know what year that would be. I have no idea. I mean, I know I read about her in the NME. That much I do know. And I was really intrigued. I was like, who is this woman? This cool, incredible, freaky creature who can play guitar and look cool. And I was quite jealous, actually. I was like sort of driven mad by her talent and her voice. I think she's got a phenomenal voice. I'm obsessed with her. And just before I left for America, I remember To Bring You My Love came out, and I was just like, this is a perfect record. This is a perfect record. I loved everything about it, and the production, and this freedom you could feel off her. Like, it's almost like she'd stepped into a robe and crown. It was just a really powerful moment. And yeah, I admire her very much. I will be a lifelong fan.
I feel like people are looking back and going, you know, I love that band. And people are discovering that band for the first time and going, what a fantastic group. It does feel like there's a wave of affection and respect and enthusiasm kind of feel it happening. It's true.
Everyone's bemused, including us. I mean, I always approach life like I'm fighting. And to all of a sudden feel like people are welcoming us again...
That feels quite odd.
It feels really weird, and I don't quite
You're
know
letting
what
me
to
in
do
here?
With it. Yeah, but I'm really, really grateful. Particularly, you know, I'm happy for my band and happy for myself. But more than anything, I realise how rare it is for a woman to be 51 in a band, making records, touring the world. I'm like one of a very few women who've managed to do it. And I feel really privileged. I'm like, how did this happen to me, this idiot that I am? How did I manage to shuffle together for long enough to have a career like this? And, you know, have you ever seen that movie Zelig with Woody Allen? Yeah. Well, I am Zelig because I'm always in these incredible photos where everybody's extraordinary. And then there's me looking like my normal, ordinary, weirdo self. And I'm like, how the hell did I end up in a photograph, you know, with, I don't know, the Ramones. How did I end up being in a photograph with you two or, you know, whoever, Blondie? I mean, it's just crazy. My life has been mad. I'm very grateful. And I'm most grateful of all to be happy, to be in a place in my life where I'm happy, where I can really enjoy it and feel gratitude and understand the privilege.
So you're not doubting it anymore. You're enjoying it.
No, I'm not doubting it. I think that's fair to say. I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. You know, I kept thinking it was all going to disappear on me and I'd be left with no trace, no memory even. And now I understand if it goes away tomorrow, I'll have something tangible and I'll have lasted long enough to know it wasn't just a puff of wind that came in through the door and, you know, got held up by the wind. Well, that was the weirdest analogy ever. I don't even know what I'm talking about here.
What's the final song that we should play?
No Horses by Garbage.
Why that song?
Because it's brilliant. You're and not. It's topical. And yeah, I'm proud of it. We wrote it last year. It came out. It's probably the most political song we've ever written. And I think it has some poetic heartbreak in it.
It's been lovely to speak to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
They'll love you too. They'll love you too. They'll love you too.
Music.
This is Six Music.
Fools, they think I do not know the road I'm taking. If you meet me on the way, hesitating, that is just because I know which way I will choose. The corridors of discontent that I've been traveling on the lonely search for truth. The world's so frightening, nothing's going right today, 'cause nothing ever does.
Interested in just mishmashing the sound and see what you get.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favorites.
Well, we don't have a set list. We're trying to ensure that every show is different.
This is Old Noughties on BBC Sounds.